The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
I just want to get an assessment from you as to how you think things are going right now in terms of, you know, there's people who say, you know, show me another economy anywhere in the world that the United States would trade places with. And most of the time people just say we're in a better situation than anybody. But at the same time, we've got people who talk about the yield-starved environment. You know, from your standpoint, a guy who's dealing with the wealth of high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals, how do you see the situation right now?
So that's a good question. I think when you think about, I'll back it up and, you know, talk about, I guess, the idea of wealth first. We saw a study last year that showed that the world in the United States in itself as well has never been wealthier in every asset class in terms of population of folks, as well as you know, total dollars invested, total dollars of net worth. And that includes the 100,000 to a million category, the million to 5 million, 5 million to 25, and 25 million and up. They're all at record levels. And so the world has, and the United States has gotten ultimately wealthy, and certainly rebounded from the financial crisis, and where it seemed to be obviously a much tougher environment. When you think about the outlook, we certainly have clients that are seeking yield, as you discussed, seeking income replacement. But we've also found that it's become less about a specific asset class or a specific request like yield or like income, but more of, I've got a complex financial picture, and I want someone to help dissect my financial picture and look at every asset class and look at every category and really understand me, you know, emotionally, understand my family governance considerations, and spend more time on that. So we're seeing sort of the question base of clients change, where it isn't all investment focused. It may be the reason for that is a lot of them feel like they've got their money back, or they are at a new level of wealth, and it's just brought about sort of a different mindset of where they are in their life.
What do you see as the biggest issue? People who are kind of replete with wealth, and they're bringing kind of that, you know, set of questions to you. Are you seeing any commonality in terms of there's a particular thorny issue or something that you deal with more than anything else?
We're seeing an increased categorization of the next generation of wealth and understanding how to give money to their children. We call it the choking on the silver spoon phenomenon, but high net worth families are asking a lot of questions about the idea of spoiling their kids or what's an appropriate distribution schedule. A lot of asset structuring questions in terms of specifically with the post-election tax considerations. You know, so estate taxes are coming back up, asset transfer questions are coming up, valuation questions are coming up. And then as a firm, which is an area that we play in as well, from the investment banking side, we're seeing folks that own businesses that are looking for either succession plans for their business, liquidity events for their business, and that real asset that they have has become, you know, something that they're that is an issue to them because they may be getting older or they don't have a good succession plan, and that's become an area where they want to spend some time.
So let's delve a little bit more deeply on this idea of I've built the relative fortune, I've got children, I don't want them to be spoiled, I have concerns about wealth preservation. Is one of the strategies, I've always thought that if I was a wealthy person with children, that I would set up, I wouldn't just simply hand off a bundle of money upon my death or even an early inheritance, but to have some sort of trust that paid out money each year to them over the course of time so that they couldn't, in their youthful indiscretion, blow it all. Is there a lot of that that goes on, just kind of parsing out the money and smaller denominations so that the family wealth can't get, you know, for lack of a better term, pissed away by by kids who haven't really don't really understand all that goes into making money and that it is exhaustible.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, Mike. So we're seeing a few different trends take shape. You're seeing wealthy families actually start to spend their money during their lifetime, and so they may be gifting to their kids now versus, you know, when I pass, this is what I want to do on a distribution schedule. And they're doing it more for, I would call it, experiential living, and where they're saying, you know, I want to see my kids enjoy some of this while we're alive instead of leaving a pile of money and hoping that they use it correctly. You're also seeing families that are working to take care of generations that they haven't met yet and basing the distribution of those assets around principles. So in other words, they may set up a donor advised fund or family foundation that has certain philanthropic considerations and will want that next generation or two generations down to be involved in making the decisions for that family foundation's philanthropic efforts. And so you're seeing principles surrounding capital that in many ways have changed how folks are giving and how folks are actually giving their money to their children. Now, we still have folks that, hey, I want my kids to have everything that I've worked for, and God bless them, and I don't care how they spend it. All the way to the other end of the spectrum is I'm not going to give my children a dime, and we're going to fund universities, education, arts, and some of their philanthropic causes. But what's more of a theme for us is that folks that have created a lot of capital are spending more time on those questions than they have in the past versus just pure investment questions.
Mm. So a huge issue for wealth advisory firms like William Blair is here's the generational wealth transfer, and are young people actually going to follow in mom and dad's footsteps and stick with their financial advisor or even with the same organization? There's a lot of young people who today feel that, you know, there's an app for everything. It's not just the robo-advisor route, but I have access to information, tremendous amount of information. I can make my own decisions, including, you know, maybe going into alternatives and investing in something like BDCs or MLPs or what have you. How big an issue, how are you guys dealing with that? I mean, it's got to be a concern because there's so much wealth that's going to be changing hands. What are you doing to prepare to hold on to the next generation of clients and even expand your client base? I know that's a broad question. Why don't we start with just
yep.
holding on to the transferred, the next generation?
Yep. So that is a challenge of every firm, and ours included, where we've got a aging advisor base, and the advisor base has an aging client base. And so one of the big challenges we have, like most wealth management firms, is assuring that we're getting introductions to showing value and showing solutions for that next generation. What's helped us, I believe, is that we are a very stable, consistent, and long-term oriented firm. And so the multi-generational relationships that we have, we've arguably done a better job of keeping those assets as they transfer to the next generation. You know, we don't have a lot of folks that have changed firms a bunch of times or done different things that where it could disrupt or allow the client to make a different decision or the next generation to make a different decision. And so that's helped us in that bridge. We're also seeing teams start to become more diversified, not only in their generations, but, you know, male-female considerations, diversity of talent, where somebody may be a portfolio manager and add on a younger planner, a financial planner, and where that person has helped coordinate and build a relationship with the next generation. So we're doing, I don't know that we're doing anything today that's particularly innovative, but I think our stability, consistency, and the structure of our teams has helped us in that effort.
You know, I was talking with Ron Carson just like a week or two ago, and he was talking about how the industry is not attracting young talent the way it used to. What's been your experience with that, Ryan? As William Blair, do you feel that the firm is succeeding at that, or is it a more difficult recruitment process than it used to be? And what are the big issues with young people who want to get into the profession in terms of the things they want to know or are important to them about your organization before they would agree to sign on as an employee, as a young advisor who can help usher in that next generation that we were talking about?
That's a good question. I would say I just recently heard two stats that sort of stick out in that area, that for every 8 advisors that are leaving the industry or retiring from the industry, only 3 are coming into the industry from that next generation. And that for the first time, there are more CFPs over 70 years old than there are under 40 years old. And so it's obviously two trends that the industry is facing. Our firm has, I think, sat in a unique position that we don't base and haven't based our success on number of advisors. And so we're selectively hiring and we're selectively recruiting. And the folks that we are in an effort to recruit, we want them to have a 20 and 25-year runway for us. And so we want them to have enough years left in the industry that, you know, that we can build up a sustainable team. And in doing that, we've been able to find teams. We've been able to attract younger talent that is that we, you know, we obviously hope stays for multi-decades. So I don't know that we've figured out the industry problem, but we certainly have done a nice job of protecting ourselves and growing appropriately based on the teams that we're seeking. And we're doing it more of a, you know, pinpoint approach versus a let's just see how many people we can hire.
Now, you mentioned teams. So have you is that part of the strategy? You've been recruiting teams from smaller organizations that have been teams that have been successful with smaller organizations and bringing them aboard rather than just hitting singles?
The teams we've recruited have been recruiting tend to be first or second quintile teams from competitors, both small and large. You know, there's good advisors at a lot of different firms, and we're actively pursuing folks that have the ability to work with a high net worth client base, understand multi-generational issues, understand liquidity events and pre-liquidity planning, focus their business around financial planning and then ultimately proceeds management, as well as being diversified. We're actively outside of Chicago now, so we've opened up in New York, Boston, and Atlanta in the course of the last 3 years, and we're interested in having locations where we're having additional wealth management where we have firm locations. So we're looking right now at San Francisco and LA, and then I think ultimately we'll be in Dallas, Denver, and some other key markets.
And those markets are picked on a basis of the what the amount of wealth that exists there and is being generated there. How are markets picked? San Francisco obviously has got a huge, you know, tremendous amount of wealth. That's a pretty obvious one. But can you kind of summarize for me how the determination is made that a city will have a William Blair office?
Sure. So it's the first determination is, do we already have an office? And so our investment banking, institutional sales, and asset management divisions have been in most of those markets I've already named. And so they've been in Boston, they've been in New York, they are in San Francisco, and have been in those three markets in particular over a decade. Atlanta was a new market that we decided to enter, and we decided to enter it based on, one, it is a growing population in the South. We didn't have firm exposure down there. But we did have a great deal of investment banking exposure with companies that we were selling. And so from a firm's perspective, we wanted to assure that it's a market that we could succeed in, and then we found a team that ultimately helped us achieve scale relatively quickly from a wealth management perspective. But so if we don't have an office there, what we're looking for is that. Is it a growing market? Are there growing demographics? So in some of the mature cities, you see what's called negative decrease. More people are leaving or dying than are moving in. And there are cities that, like Dallas and Denver and Seattle and so forth, that are growing. They're growing their wealth base. They're growing the next generation of wealth. And as a firm, we feel we need to be part of that.
Interesting. So Well, let me actually get to the list of questions here that I sent over, and I want to tie it to this kind of next generation that's going to be inheriting their parents' money, and you know, they're sitting across the desk from you, and they say, "Give me an overview of, you know, William Blair's private the private wealth management investment philosophy. What is it that your organization does that's supposed to have some gravitational pull for me?"
So I want to go back to our roots on this. This will be a long answer, but you can point to whatever bullet point you think you like in this.
Okay.
We were founded in 1935, and it was coming out of the Depression. And the idea was is that Chicago was a growing city, and it was a growing city at the time of young entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs that owned their businesses. And they owned, you know, this is back in the industrial age and the meat packaging age in Chicago, and where William Blair was basically founded to help those business owners that had real assets and had a bend towards growth. So if you look at our now 82-year culture and reputation, we've always been involved in growth. And so when we started in the same year that the investment bank started, it was to capitalize and help business owners that are going through a transaction or a transition, help them with their liquidity, and work with their families. And so when you look at what we've become, our equity growth research, our institutional sales work, our basic investment philosophy has been around growth capital. Now, what we've done is our clients have become wealthier, more mature, multi-generational, as you say. We're fully open architecture now. We pay attention on a client-by-client basis to the asset allocation, what they're really trying to accomplish. We focus a lot of that around planning and creating investment policy statements and understanding the dynamics of the wealth for them, what their capital means to them. But it's still growth-focused and has always been growth-focused.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the role of alternatives and real assets in client portfolios. Obviously, our magazine is all about that, but it's amazing how many firms are still out there with two-dimensional portfolios. It's all stocks and bonds and really nothing else. Address that in terms of the role that they play, why you're using alternatives, or as we consider real assets a subset of alternatives, what you use them for in portfolios, and then if you could also tell me, Ryan, kind of a what percentage of a portfolio, and I'm sure it's a range, but what percentage of a portfolio would be alternatives on average?
So, yep. So let me back it up for a second. Sorry, as you're getting a sense of what our firm's about, a lot of our clients already own real assets, and so their business may be their biggest asset. And in that, a lot of times that answers that private equity investment for them, where we may be dealing with a portion of liquidity because their private equity, because their real assets are tied up in their business. But then when they go through a liquidity event, if we have the opportunity to represent them on the liquidity event and we're working with new liquidity, you see that a lot of these folks were very much ingrained into the idea of understanding a business. That's how they grew up. Obviously, that's what they managed for a long period of time. And so there is certainly an allocation and an expectation that they own real assets, and if that's private equity, if that's venture capital, if that's real estate mezzanine funds, et cetera. We don't really have a set percentage, but I would say that the reason we don't have a set percentage is, again, they may still have equity ownership in a business. They may have done a role with their business, so that may be solving that problem for it. But we are seeing some changes in I guess, how alternative and real asset allocations are being formed. We're seeing less really in the hedge fund space, if we want to call that a real asset. So in the alternative class with hedge funds, whether it be from just recent underperformance or the competition of fees and their 2-in-20 model, we're seeing a lot less allocation go to hedge funds. We are seeing folks, high net worth families, have sincere interest in unique ideas, unique private equity ideas, and alternative asset classes that you know, they believe and or we've helped measure are non-correlated to the overall equity markets.
Can you throw some percentages out there just in terms of one organization I talked to recently said it could be anywhere from 5% to, you know, so we have portfolios with up to, say, 30% in alternatives.
We do everything on a client-by-client basis and, you know, take it a step further. You sit at, I sit in a meeting like I did last week with a business owner that has substantial capital and the business puts out a, you know, a substantial dividend every year. But our asset allocation model was not to put anything into alternatives or private investments because the size of the business that he owned. And so we see that a lot. And it's always on a client-by-client basis, and we don't really have a recommended pie of saying this is where we're trying to get you, you know, in real assets.
Is there a lot of private equity investing going on, or do you tend to keep everything in a liquid format where it's, you know, securitized or –
We do both. It'd be easier to tell you that we have one pie and this is how we fill in the pieces, but we really don't. And so we do see families that are interested in REITs and MLPs in a more securitized liquid basis, as you talk about. And then we do see a lot of families that have interest in private equity or placements in private deals. We're also seeing, from the ultra high net worth perspective, a new phenomenon that we've been coining as permanent capital. And so a lot of family businesses, as they go to sale into the market, are, I think, getting a little tired of PE, and where they go to a traditional sponsored fund and they know that in selling their business, that business may sell again in 3 to 5 years. That's the model of many, you know, PE firms. And so some of the operating families of businesses that they own, while still wanting PE involved in many of those transactions, will also lean towards larger family offices or ultra high net worth families to take, again, a more permanent stance in their business. And we're seeing families have interest in that because they may be trying to seed the next generation with an operating business. They may want to be using the skill set that they've built up over, you know, 50, 100 years in a business and feel like they understand business in general and want to be involved. So there's a lot of reasons that folks are getting there, but you're seeing that start to take shape, call it in the real asset world.
Let me ask you about the aversion to illiquidity. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the illiquidity premium. What I've just heard over and over again over time is that there does seem to be among clients an aversion to tying their money up. Can you speak to that generally, though, Ryan? I mean, do you find that a lot of clients have kind of an aversion to tying their money up?
It's mixed. You certainly have folks that spend a lot of their life illiquid, where they've owned a business or whatever it may be, and now they have liquidity, and I think they're valuing that liquidity and don't want to look towards another 7 to 10 year time frame of locking up a lot of those assets. And where you have others that have grown up and decided that as part of their asset allocation and longer-term considerations, they certainly are willing to take illiquid risk and invest in a way that, you know, this may pay dividends for them over time. I haven't seen a specific trend where I can say, I mean, I read the headlines, I'm sure as you do, that say that a lot of families are saying they want greater access to liquidity and less capital commitments over longer periods of time. But when you actually watch where the dollars flow, I haven't seen it change that much. I've seen, you know, we still see folks that get in longer-term private equity opportunities when there's an appropriate deal, and you see others that would never do that. And so it's sort of, again, to Tony's point, always on a client-by-client basis for us.
So do you think that percentage of alternatives and real assets are likely to increase in client portfolios for this reason? Interest rates are a concern. Inflation is a concern. Those have obviously been very much in check for quite a while, but you can just sense that people are fearful that those things are going to explode at some point. Do you see reason for alternatives and real assets to increase in portfolios because of the unpredictability of some of the economic dynamics that we expect to start to assert themselves?
this may be my own personal belief. I think actually people are looking for simplification in many ways. And simplification is stocks, bonds, cash, and then real assets. And so you're seeing them, real assets that I feel like they know or that they're accustomed to or that they've had some familiarity in their life with. And so investment cycles and interest rate cycles and inflation cycles always drive assets to certain areas, and many times it's, you know, the madness of crowds that folks get there late. But you know, I guess my viewpoint on it and is that when you're actually watching what's happening, when you're actually watching where dollars are flowing, I think folks are taking a holistic approach to their assets, and they're using stocks, bonds, and cash, and then they're using alternatives in the way that they feel appropriate. And some folks are filling in those gaps in different ways than they've ever filled them in before, whether it's having two or three homes, and that's now their real estate exposure versus a PE fund, or it's investing in a hard asset, an oil well, an ag pit, a private business. You're seeing, you know, some of the high net worth families literally just kind of go do it themselves. But then from the securitized structures, from the fund-to-fund structure, from the PE structures, you know, a lot of families, that is how they fill in their pie. But I haven't seen a significant increase in those, or, you know, and I, again, it's always client specific, but nothing has been that noticeable.
Interesting. So based on what you said, I have a couple questions on that. You, when you talk about familiarity with the real asset, I would imagine that the first go-to real asset for most people then would probably be real estate, since people tend to understand that pretty well. They own real estate. They live in a home and whatnot. Has that been your experience, Ryan, that real estate is kind of a fundamental real asset that people are comfortable with and is usually kind of that first jump?
It is, and or it's done for lifestyle purposes, but then that fills in that gap for them, right, where they may buy a home in Florida, they may buy a home in Colorado, and now they've picked up millions of dollars of real estate that we could say they're familiar with, but it may be more for lifestyle purposes and suddenly and instantly fill in their alternative bucket for them.
Now, listen, your website says, you know, I'm quoting, investment experience built on research and relationships, and I wanted to ask about the source of that research. Are you doing your own internal research, and where is that data coming from, or do you contract with people to conduct the research? Give me kind of a sketch of the intelligence that is gathered by William Blair.
Sure. So we do have an equity research division, covers over 650 mid-cap growth-oriented equities. They're looking for corporations that are either disrupting a particular industry or have a long-term sustainable growth model. In addition to the internal research, where we may drive an equity portfolio or a growth equity portfolio off those research analysts, we do utilize a group that we call consulting services internally, and this team does qualitative and quantitative research on outside SMA managers, in addition to partners that we use. So we do have outside firms that we partner with that do some initial filtering for us of the mutual fund, ETF, and SMA universe, and then we apply our analytics and research internally around that to get to the client level, to say these are managers that if you're looking for a specific asset class that we recommend based on your needs. So it's both internal and external.
Okay, and you know, the relationship also talks about building relationships. You've alluded to that, and you know, it's a big deal for somebody to say, here's my money, I'm going to entrust you with managing it or helping me manage it. And there needs to be a level of trust there. And you know, people do business with people they feel good about. So how are those relationships built? Do you guys use any particular tools?
I like that you asked this question. I like to obviously talk very fondly of the firm that I'm a partner in. But I think first you back up and you say, look, our organization doesn't advertise. And so you don't see us out in the papers. You don't see us actively, you know, with billboards and so forth. And so we have to be pretty good at taking care of our clients to keep the ones we have and find new ones. And so we try to build a base of advisors that people like and trust, to your point. And if we have folks that they like and trust and we do a good job for them, that they'll refer additional business. But then you add to that, we talk about the business owner segment. You know, we have one of the world's largest investment banks, and certainly in the mid-market space. And so these are folks that, in the way we define mid-market, is $100 million to $2 billion enterprise value. And in seeing what's going on in that world, right, with the number of transactions, the number of liquidity events that are taking shape, we help guide and advise those business owners when appropriate through that transaction. So our folks, to your point of how do we develop relationships with them, our firm has perhaps built a relationship with them and being assigned to sell their business, and then we work closely with those teams to earn the trust of making sure that they're personally properly prepared for the transaction through sophisticated pre-liquidity planning, that they feel good going through the transaction. And then afterwards, if we've done a good job, obviously we want to manage the proceeds. So we've got a stable FA base that's done a nice job growing their book of business. We've got a good referral base based on the clients that we've had. And then we've got a reputation of helping business owners as a firm. And so that's helped our private client organization.
You know, a lot of young people, when they're going out into the world, they're thinking in terms of, you know, how do you really make money out there? What do you see in terms of the leading sources of wealth generation these days?
Yeah, we're seeing an increasing, pronouncement of that next generation of wealth. We're seeing younger wealth like we've never seen it before. And I think to your question, it's been through business ownership. It's been through it's an awfully brilliant generation, the ones behind us, and so it's innovations, liquidity events perhaps that they've had, it's inheritance, it's savings that their parents did for them, and it seems to me that the next generation, the millennials and the Gen Z, seem to be savers and investors. And so we're seeing these multi-generational high-net-worth families in conjunction with new wealth have a complex capital picture, and they are needing advice. And so we like to be in a place that if we've done a good job or we can get introduction to them, that will be a place that they think about to put that capital.
I tell you what, let me ask you to characterize, you've already done this to some extent, Ryan, but I just, if you can put it in a nutshell, how would you describe the organization's, client base?
I guess a couple different ways. You know, one of the things that we say out loud is that we provide advice to good people. And so when you think about the folks that we serve, a lot of them have surrounded business ownership. A lot of them are longer term mindset investors, and where they're leaning on a firm like ours. So, I mean, your client base sort of becomes what you are, and being a private partnership, being quiet, being stable, we're trying to work with folks that look a lot like that. And I think that's exactly who we serve. We've grown $10 billion in assets and actual client assets in the last 4 years. And so I feel like we're doing a lot of things right in that area. And we're pretty proud of the quality of folks that we have and the growth trajectory that we've been on. So
how is that happening?
Can help.
What's driving that?
So it's been a few things. It's been the recruiting effort, as we've talked about. It's been the liquidity effort, which has been the investment bank's tremendous growth that they've had, and some success that we've had in helping those clients. But it's also been to the questions you asked earlier about taking care of the next generation. We're finding as we've expanded our platform and the next generation has asked for additional tools, additional technologies, that we've invested in those technologies, we've invested in those tools, and our reputation has maintained a very consistent and sound stance that the families are coming to us, and we can answer, you know, the questions and the needs of the patriarch as well as the questions and the needs of that next generation. And so that has, I think, helped propel us to have the growth that we've had.